Good evening, everyone. I'm Lynn Ormoudou. Welcome to Health Chat. World AIDS Day is this week on December 1st. This year's theme is Know Your Status. For the 30th anniversary of the annual event, observers say significant progress has been made in the AIDS response since 1988. For example, today, 3 in 4 people living with HIV know their status, but a lot remains to be done. And that includes reaching people living with HIV who do not know their status and ensuring that they are linked to quality care and prevention services. So we will take a look at the HIV/AIDS epidemic on the program today. And first of all, experts warn of a return of the AIDS epidemic. And Voice of America reporter Carol Pearson has the story. Take a listen.
The face of AIDS has changed over the past 3 decades. It's now impossible to tell who has the disease and who doesn't. Treatment has come a long way, allowing people infected with what was once a death sentence to live normal, productive lives. Even those at risk of getting the virus can now take medication called PrEP, or pre-exposure prophylaxis, to stay HIV-free. Dr. Chris Byrer says it's just the latest weapon in the growing medical arsenal against AIDS.
It's the most powerful new tool in prevention we've had in a generation of research. And what we're seeing is that if you combine treatment, so people living with the virus getting treated, and then people at risk having access to PrEP, you really can get control of HIV epidemic.
Yet AIDS claimed the lives of nearly 1 million people last year, and experts predict 100 million people will have been infected with the HIV virus by 2030. The reasons: complacency, reduced funding for AIDS research and treatment, and the difficulty of reaching people at risk. Another major problem, says Dr. Deborah Birx, the U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator, is flagging government interest.
When we talk to ministers of finance, they always say to me, I thought HIV was over because I don't see anybody dying.
New AIDS infections are down from nearly 3.5 million a year, but remain stuck at just below 2 million. J. Stephen Morrison at the Center for Strategic and International Studies says there are currently 17 million people living with HIV who cannot be reached. Men who have sex with men, IV drug users, sex workers and their clients, and transgender people.
Those key populations and young women account for over 50% of new infections, and they are really hard to reach.
Morrison, Birx, and Byrer discuss the challenges in ending AIDS at a program in Washington to evaluate the messages from the International AIDS Conference in July. Byrer said the warning came through loud and clear.
And it is much too early to declare victory, and the risks of a resurgent epidemic are real.
The National Institutes of Health announced an international program to find ways to reduce the social stigma associated with AIDS. Domestically, the health agency found the highest number of untreated AIDS infections among the poor and in the Black and Hispanic communities. The agency says closing these treatment gaps is critical to ending AIDS in the U.S. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
And we continue to look at HIV/AIDS, which is the focus of our show today. Next, Voice of America's Darren Taylor takes us to South Africa with this report on why young women seem to be more at risk of HIV infection.
HIV experts from the Center for the AIDS Program of Research in South Africa, or CAPRISA, have shown that relationships between older men and young women are driving epidemics across the continent. The women, mostly in their teens and early 20s, are poor and become involved with men who are on average 9 years older than them. The men are more likely to have steady incomes and so provide the young women with basic necessities such as food. But the men who are generally between the ages of 25 and 35 also have high rates of HIV and pass it on to their young lovers.
This age disparity is the reason why Africa has 70% of the global HIV epidemic.
CAPRISA director, Professor Salim Karim, says this motivated him and other scientists to investigate why young women in South Africa are so much more vulnerable to getting HIV than any other group.
Are they having so much of sex? Well, the answer to that is no. In fact, all of our research shows young girls have very little sex. If they're having sex once a month, that's a lot.
So in the light of this, the CAPRISA team asked itself, why are so many young women in South Africa getting HIV? After a study involving 120 infected women, the answer they've come up with is because of genital inflammation.
They simply get HIV after a few acts of sex because this inflammation enhances their risk of acquiring HIV.
Karim says of all the 3,500 organisms present in the vagina that the scientists isolated, only one was common to the women who had genital inflammation.
This is our big new discovery. Basically, we showed that an organism, a bacterium called Prevotella bivia, is the main culprit. It increases your risk of HIV about 19-fold. This bug has a strong association with genital inflammation.
He explains that the Prevotella bug releases a molecule that helps HIV establish itself in cells.
Probably accounts for 40 to 50% of the HIV we see in young girls.
Karim explains that when younger women have intercourse, there's a lot more reaction in the vagina when compared with more sexually experienced women.
The younger you are, the more likely you are to have this inflammation when you have sex. It's just part and parcel of your body just reacting naturally to what it's supposed to be doing.
What isn't natural, though, says Karim, is that so many young women are being exposed to men with high viral loads because the men don't know they have HIV and thus aren't on treatment. That, plus the overabundance of Prevotella, is leading to spiking levels of HIV infection among young women in South Africa.
It increases your risk multiply. We don't know how much.
Medical scientists say the Prevotella bug is present naturally in women all over. Normally, it's kept under control by other good bugs that ensure the environment in the vagina is too acidic for Prevotella to thrive. But among women in South Africa, this isn't the case, and the bacteria are occurring at extremely high levels. At this point in time, Karim and his team don't know why this is happening, but they're probing a number of possibilities, some related to maintenance, or lack thereof, of vaginal hygiene. Until they have hard evidence, though, they won't be able to solve the problem, and the biggest HIV epidemic in the world will be getting even bigger. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Durban.
And if you're just joining us today, we are focusing on HIV/AIDS. Next, Voice of America's Kim Lewis takes a close look at the work of the Elizabeth Taylor Foundation on HIV/AIDS.
The Elizabeth Taylor AIDS Foundation was established by the late Hollywood actress and AIDS activist Elizabeth Taylor in 1991. The foundation provides grants to existing organizations for domestic and international programs that offer direct care services to people living with HIV and AIDS. Layla Wilding, the granddaughter of the late actress, is an ambassador with the foundation. She attended the AIDS conference to highlight that HIV stigmas still persist today. She said lack of communication and criminalizing people with HIV are major factors contributing to stigma.
Something that we're focused on in the Elizabeth Taylor AIDS Foundation is comprehensive sexual health education. We are hoping that by increasing communication in that area, that it will begin to reduce stigma in families and among young people. We find that young people aren't currently as aware of HIV as they once were. Another effort that we focus on in our foundation is advocacy around criminalization of people living with HIV, both in the United States and in the world.
Wilding says one of the most damaging types of stigma is the criminalization of a person who is living with HIV/AIDS. In many places around the world, this could mean labeling a person a sexual offender just because they are HIV positive.
In the U.S., we have two-thirds states that have laws that criminalize people living with HIV, and there are over 68 countries in the world that have similar laws. Often those laws are simply about disclosure. So we have tools to greatly reduce new cases of HIV, but we need to ensure access to tests, access to care, and to create environments where people are comfortable and encouraged to get tested and know their status.
Robert Suttle is an AIDS activist and advocate for people who have been stigmatized by outdated laws regarding HIV status. He was also a participant at the 2018 AIDS conference, not only as an advocate, but someone who has experienced firsthand this type of stigma.
To have these HIV criminalization laws, it's the greatest manifestation of stigma, and to have it enshrined in the law, and that pretty much allows for stigmatization legally. The point is they're outdated, they do not reflect the current science that we know today around HIV. And so as Layla has alluded to, we definitely have the tools to now start addressing HIV criminalization reform in a way that is proven and tested. Just recently, we had the opening of the HIV expert consensus statement that was released on July 25th here at the conference. And the statement was written both to assist scientific experts and anyone from a prosecutor or any type of government official that are considering criminal cases, that any application of the criminal law in cases related to HIV is informed by any scientific evidence rather than stigma and fear.
Charged with not disclosing to a partner that he was HIV positive, Suttle was prosecuted and sent to prison in a U.S. state. He says he did disclose his HIV status to the person. The individual subsequently did not test positive for HIV.
In my case, I did 6 months in prison and also had to register as a sex offender. The stigma still follows you in terms of someone who's formerly incarcerated and also someone who is living with HIV who was prosecuted under these draconian laws. And this is, again, a phenomenon that happens worldwide. So a lot of people are experiencing stigma in more than one way around the HIV status and also within the criminal justice system.
Suttle explains that in some U.S. states, once you have disclosed that you are HIV positive, you are labeled a sexual offender without ever committing a crime.
For example, in the United States, in Louisiana, they require that you put sex offender on your driver's license. So just imagine having that indicated on your passport or any form of ID that you're a registered sex offender, and just think about in a general public what that can mean. But the thing is, people living with HIV are being prosecuted simply based on their status, something that they cannot change. And as a result, the collateral consequences are they're being labeled sex offenders and predators and things like that that are so far from the potential harm or any harm or risk that may have been done.
Both Suttle and Wilding say one major way of avoiding being stigmatized criminally is for people with HIV to be educated on what is considered criminally liable. They emphasize that communities, families, stakeholders, medical workers, and lawmakers also be educated on the science of HIV. In both developed and developing countries, a person should feel safe to disclose his or her HIV status without the fear of stigmatization. Kim Lewis, VOA News, Washington.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Welcome back. For those of you joining us late tonight, we take a look at HIV AIDS as World AIDS Day is coming up December 1st. Now, Maureen Muranga is a young mother from Kenya. She has a teenage son who is living with HIV and a four-year-old son who was born HIV-free. She's a spokesperson for the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation, EGPAF, and she's the founder and executive director of the Lean On Me Foundation, a nonprofit organization that helps adolescent girls and young women with treatment adherences in Nairobi. I spoke to Maureen and asked her about her life and experience as a person living with HIV/AIDS, as well as her advocacy work. Take a listen. Maureen Muranga, welcome to the Voice of America.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. Listen, you are here in the United States for a specific reason, one of which being the EGPAF anniversary. So tell us more about the reason of your visit.
I'm honored to be here on the 30th anniversary of the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation that supports actually ending of pediatric AIDS globally. And it was such a pleasure to be in that room at the Capitol Hill with the partners and to see how people in the U.S. are actually committed to ending pediatric AIDS. This is important to me because I am a woman living with HIV, and I have a child who is HIV positive. So I know the challenges of pediatric AIDS. And I also know that this can also be eliminated, because after all the work that people have done, including Elizabeth Glaser, we have seen that HIV positive mothers can have HIV negative children. So I also have a HIV negative child. So celebrating 30 years is actually celebrating a milestone, celebrating time when people are hopeless into a moment when we can actually end, and we know in our generation we can end pediatric AIDS. So that was quite a moment for me.
So talk to us about your journey. You have a child who is HIV negative, one who is positive, and you are positive. How did it all start for you in terms of finding out and looking back from where you started to where you are now? What can you tell us?
I can say so much has happened, and the HIV epidemic has changed its face. When I was diagnosed with HIV, I was a young woman in the early 2002 actually. I was a young woman and I had all these dreams and visions. But I was diagnosed when we were told there was no treatment. Actually, when the doctor told you, I was given a maximum of 2 years to live. So that was compounded by a pregnancy that I had, and the doctor changed the 2 years to almost a year. He told me, now that you're pregnant, you may not live long enough because your immune system is going to be compromised. So it was such a scary time, and majority of people in my country could not afford treatment. A few could in private hospitals, which was very, very expensive, but for the common person it wasn't. So it was a time when you know you are dying, you're pregnant with this child, you don't know how they're going to survive. It was a very stigmatized condition, so it's, you're also rejected and you're in this lonely like kind of life. So when I had the baby, and after a while he was tested when he was 9 months old and I was told he's HIV positive, that broke me down, because I knew he had gotten him. There was that feeling of guilt as a mother, and knowing that it's not just any other health condition, it's a stigmatized health condition without treatment. So it was a very uncertain feeling. I didn't know whether I wanted to die first and leave my child in a world that was very unfriendly, or I live, or he dies first and I remain lonely. So it was quite a very difficult moment for us. We got conned. I mean, people brought us everything. And for a mother who wants to stay alive and wants the child to stay alive, you try anything. People brought us concoctions, telling us they could cure HIV. We were brought herbs. We were brought just about anything.
So tell me, because you say people came to you with these concoctions. Did you come out? How did they find out, given that the big stigma around HIV and you were concerned, did you just talk to your community or just a few people, and these people were the one who were trying to help?
What happened is that in that moment, first of all, my status, I didn't have time to keep my HIV status to myself. It was told to me in public at the health facility, at the reception. So a few people who knew me, who I at the reception already knew my HIV status. And then someone went and told my employer, who also told my colleagues, and I lost my job as a result, because I was working in a learning institution where they didn't allow then people living with HIV to mingle with other people's children. So I didn't have like a moment to internalize my HIV status and live with it in private and stuff like that. So later when, after I had my baby and I thought I was dying, and someone approached me and told me there's this group of women who have HIV, and I see them coming together talking, maybe if you talk to them you'll feel better about yourself. So I joined a support group of women living with HIV, and that is now where people targeted. So it was not... It was difficult for people to join the support group, because when people knew you're HIV positive, then you faced a lot of rejection, you faced a lot of sometimes violence and stuff like that. So the few of us who were in this support group were targeted by all manner of concoctions and solutions and things people came up with saying that those could cure HIV.
Hmm. So now, fast forward where you are now, you have a child who is HIV negative. So, and you are with now EGPAF, the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation. What made that journey for you possible?
The journey was made possible, first of all, by advocates. We have people who have come out of their way to push the world to find solutions for HIV. So through that and the U.S. government taking the leadership in the AIDS response, managed to avail treatment to countries such as mine. And therefore my son and I were enrolled on treatment. Then we didn't still have pediatric ARVs in my country, or pediatric treatment for HIV in my country. Mm-hmm. So I would break the adult tablet into two, and sometimes one side would be smaller than the other, and you don't know which one to give at what time. But through those challenges, we kept advocating for better treatment for children. And with time, we found better treatment for children, and therefore my son and I are still alive because of that effort.
That's fantastic.
Yes, and because of that effort too, and because I was able to be enrolled on treatment, I had another baby, and now he didn't get the infection.
That's fantastic. Yeah. So now, what do you see as some of the priorities with regards to children with pediatric AIDS, addressing pediatric AIDS? I know a lot of people talk about the fact that there is a need for more treatment. A variety of treatment for children. What is your take on that?
Yes, I think that's very right. There is a need for a variety of treatment for children. And I think organizations like Elizabeth Glaser have done quite a lot of work to actually work with scientists, push the agenda to advocates like us to run with it in the part of the world where we come from. And as much as we celebrate the miles we have made, we are not yet there, because mm-hmm. not all children who are HIV positive can actually access the treatment.
Yes.
And some of those who access it access some not very friendly bitter syrups that could be made better. And besides that, I think we should also focus on ensuring as little as possible children get infected, mm-hmm. because it's possible to prevent mother-to-child transmission of HIV. So it's a dual kind of operation where mm-hmm. you are ensuring we have fewer babies infected, but for those who are infected, we have better commodities, we have better drugs for them. You're supposed to be cuddling with your child, but they're running away from you because you give them bitter pills every evening or something like that. So you become the enemy.
Yes.
There are women who tell me that when they open the cabinet, their children run away because they think it's time to get that bitter thing out of there and into their mouths. Mm. So I think it's still frustrating for some mothers. And I know we need a lot of political goodwill. We need a lot of resources. We need a lot of scientific goodwill to come up with better pediatric formulations.
Now you are also the founder and executive director of the Lean on Me Foundation.
Yes.
Tell us about what your organization does.
Lean on Me Foundation was founded based on my experience as a woman living with HIV. I was young. I had this baby. I didn't know what to do. And as Al grew up, I started thinking of a lot of things. I used to say, because I was always very protective of him. I would always hug him every time he went through a stigmatizing process. I would talk to him to help him overcome the stigma and stuff like that.
And that's your
but
son.
But I thought, yes. Yeah, that's my son, Al. So I thought, what if I'm not there? Who would do this? And I thought I needed something bigger than just me, something that would always be there for Al, and not only Al, but other children like Al. So that was the reason I founded Lean on Me Foundation, and we work with adolescents and young women, supporting access, adherence, and retention to treatment and other HIV services.
What kind of impact have you seen?
I've seen a lot of impact. I should say that in terms of the children that come to Lean on Me have better confidence than other children that haven't come to our center or haven't received the kind of services we give. And that confidence also supports in treatment retention because they understand why they are taking treatment. They accept their HIV status. They are able to deal with different forms of stigma and they have already dealt with self-stigma. So that kind of confidence, that kind of building their self-esteem helps quite a lot, even in their performance in school. So we have seen, I must say the adolescent group is very challenging, and we see most of adolescents who are doing well as children become sick when they're adolescents, and some of them die. So we have seen the ones that in our group live, like, we don't see so many deaths with the adolescents in our group, so we know we are doing something right.
Very
yeah,
well.
Yeah.
So before we wrap, what would you like to see moving forward, whether it's personally with your organization or the global fight against HIV/AIDS?
First of all, I would say the U.S. government has been taking leadership in the AIDS response, and many other countries look up to the U.S. leadership. So I think this is very important as we continue in the cascade of ending the epidemic or defeating the epidemic, that U.S. should continue with the leadership of the global AIDS response. I also say that we need a lot of support and actually a recognition of organizations like EGPAF, because the impact around what EGPAF has done is seen worldwide. And they have right now, they're in 19 countries right now with over 5,000 sites. That is not small. And I have seen so much benefit in my country in terms of ensuring that children born with HIV live and that mothers who are HIV positive get HIV-free babies. So I think ending the epidemic among children is possible. It is doable. Science has proven that this can be done. We just need to scale up what we are doing. We need to be to do the right things and reach out to everyone. We should not leave anyone behind.
Maureen, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
And that was Maureen Muranga, HIV activist and executive director of the Lean on Me Foundation in Nairobi, Kenya. And that's all the time we have for this edition of Health Chat. For more on today's show, log on to our website at voanews.com/health, and also keep the conversation going on facebook.com/voahealthchat. Until next time, thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Lenore Moudou in Washington, with producer Bonsa Toufa. Take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy day.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil.